Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 47 of Archaeology and Ale, a free monthly public archaeology talk brought to you by Archaeology in the City, the community outreach programme from the University of Sheffield's Department of Archaeology. This month our guest speaker is local historian and archaeologist Ken Dash, who will be talking about his time with the Museum of London and how excavation was changing in the 1970s. So we better get started, because Ken's in for about 3 hours tonight.
What? I need to go home.
For those who don't know me, my name's Steve Hollings, and on behalf of Archaeology in the City, I welcome you all to our latest Archaeology in Ale talk, which we've made into a podcast, and should be released in the next couple of weeks. Just want to say thank you to Emily and the team here at our spiritual home, the Red Deer. Please drink sensibly and eat as much food as you can, and then they let us have the facilities for nothing.
It's gotcha.
As I say, Ken's going to speak for an hour, so there'll be opportunities for questions afterwards. With no further ado, I will hand over to the legend that is Ken.
Oh, God.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. You've been a lovely audience, I should say. But, I actually put this talk together, was it 12 years ago? I gave it to Bolsterstone, wasn't it? But this is like a different version.
Not 12
years ago? I think it's 2011, something like that, yeah.
You were special.
Yeah. None of that here. So really, this is, I'm afraid it's full of grainy black and white photos from almost 50 years ago, so don't expect anything with modern technology. They're taken with my old Nikon camera, black and white film, in the days of film. So really, this is it's a bit of a retrospective. I spent a year and a half working for the Department of Urban Archaeology, Museum of London, from the spring of 75 through the autumn of 76, and I came back briefly in 77. So it's that, but it's also a bit of a like a personal biography. And also, when I was chatting to Steve about what we should show, I thought, let's show how archaeological excavating techniques were changing in the early 70s. A lot of the things you now see as standard were being adopted then, nearly 50 years ago. So it's, which one is it? It's this one, right. So here we go. One or two embarrassing photographs. That's me, my first dig, age 19. And I was working for the Prudential, believe it or not, as an insurance clerk. And it was boring, and I swapped a three-piece suit for that and went digging. And this is, if you know London, this is the famous Royal Naval College, now Greenwich University. And there's the Queen's House and the Royal Observatory up on the hill. I think this is made by Sir Christopher Wren, if I remember rightly. And that's the excavation, all but forgotten now, of Henry VIII's palaces, the Palace of Placentia. There's only one known drawing of it by a Dutch spy called Van der Weingard, and we found what he drew. We actually found here, this was the Thames foreshore in the 1500s. This is now obviously dry land, and the Thames is now out here, having been embanked. But I think the bit I was digging was there. So that's I thought this was all archaeology is going to be like this, because we're finding gold and silver and goodness knows what else. In fact, the director, Phil Dixon once came up to me with his hands like that, and he said, I'm going to show you this for 3 seconds. He opened his hands, and there were 5 gold quarter marks in a rotted leather purse. And they're in the Maritime Museum now. They're in there somewhere. I think where they were, I saw them there. So I thought all digging was going to be like this, unknown to me, it's going to be more like Castleton, but never mind. So, yeah, this is, to illustrate a difference in technique, that's me again, I'm afraid. Much thinner version of me with lots of bushy hair at Bayham Abbey in Kent. To illustrate a difference in technique, really, it's the only dig I was on where we recorded the site in Imperial units, because it started back in the 60s. So the plans, everyone does them now at 1 to 10 or 1 to 20. There's a scale of 1 to 24, 1 inch to 2 feet. So, yeah, it's a sort of a research dig. It's this beautiful, I think it's a pre-Monstratensian abbey in Kent.
So what safety equipment were you wearing there, Ken? Steel tail caps?
There's a trowel there, that's all, I think, yeah.
And your colleague at the back? Yes, I'm not sure we can do that nowadays.
No, you'll see something even more scary in a bit. In 74, July 74, I worked at the excavation of an Iron Age farmstead, 3 Milestone or Penhale in Cornwall. This is the only site I've ever been on, and I don't think any of you will ever been on something like this, where the site grid, as we record them in squares now, but the director, Joshua Schweisser, set out the site grid in equilateral triangles. There were no planning frames in those days. We literally used to get a tape measure from a peg on a grid and extend it out to whatever we're doing and do it by triangulation, which is very tedious. And he thought, if we're going to do triangulation, let's do it by literally triangulating on an equilateral triangle grid. Thanks to Colin, who gave me his email address, I contacted Joshua just a few weeks ago. And lo and behold, he had the site plans in his attic. He actually fetched them down. He's a bit shamefaced. He'd never in 49 years given them to the Truro Museum. So here they are. This is that there is, of course, that there. So you can just about see. There's a peg there, peg there, peg there, peg there, peg there. It's the whole thing is set out in equilateral triangles. No one's ever used that before or since, to my knowledge, unless you have any, it's a one-off. But it shows you how techniques are changing. Another vision of the past, in the autumn of 74, I was excavating up here in Dover Castle in Kent. They were doing a drainage ditch around the castle, and just with a JCB, and we're recording the sections. And one day, the bottom of the JCB's scoop broke through. And people say, oh, there's tunnels everywhere. We actually found a medieval tunnel. There's pottery in it dating to around 1300. We didn't have a site camera because we were just a sort of washing brief. So I actually had to phone the Ministry of Public Building and Works, as it was then. And this man from the ministry came out from London. He took the site photographs with this thing. I mean, this is the nearest I found on the internet. One of these bellows cameras that, you put a hood over yourself. And it was not even film. It was a glass plate camera. Yeah. This is what I'm trying to illustrate, how much things have changed in 50-odd years. Yeah. And this is then I started, the following spring, I started with the Museum of London. It was set up in 1973 to conduct a program of excavation and research into various aspects of the city's origins and development. There was still then, even in the 70s, a lot of bomb damage being repaired, excavated, built on in the City of London. So I started in March 75. They're running 2 major digs. I started with what's called the GPO, because it was a post office, site on Newgate Street, which is quite near to to St. Paul's Cathedral. And I'll show you more of this later, but the excavated area is about 50 by 80 metres. These huge area excavations were very typical of the 1970s. So that's where the site was. There's St. Paul's Cathedral, of course, and there we are. That's street level there. And by the time we got down to this level, we were about the level of the 12th, 13th century, maybe. So everything before that had just been stripped out. And this strange thing here is a ventilation shaft. That's early work. That's in the first few weeks. You can see this is that's the excavation director, who's a beatnik, as you can see from the clothing he's wearing. Oh, excuse me. This is why you need beer. Oh, that's just 4 of my sort of digging buddies. Lost touch with them all. This guy I won't name him, but he's married to an MP now in North London and got lots of children, so you better keep him quiet. That's a medieval wall being excavated. And yes, this is a rope. That's how we got down into the thing. That's health and safety, yeah? And at tea break, you just call that, and you have to climb up this rope to get out of the ditch. techniques are very, very different then. That's Debbie, one of my housemates, climbing out of a similar ditch. That's Dave. In fact, Dave's 70th birthday party is soon. I'm going to his birthday bash in London. So I'm in touch with a lot of these people still. That's Barbie. She lives in Wales now with her husband. And yeah, I still know all these people, which is, that's the nicest thing about it, because you're all young. Perhaps in many years' time, you'll all know each other. Keep in touch. It's worth it. That's excavating a medieval pit. Everything was cut through and cut through and cut through by later incursions. And this is a more general view of the site. This is this enormous ventilation shaft. Again, there's street level. There's Alan, the site director. And this ventilation shaft, what most people don't know, there's actually two underground systems in London. This is the second one. It's run by the Post Office, GPO, ran for 75 years from 1927 to 2003. It's 21 metres below the London streets. You can actually look it up on the internet now, so I guess the shaft we had was that one there. And it was just a tiny underground train. They actually do tourist rides on it now. You can climb into this tiny little thing. It just took all the post, the mail, all the way underground through London from one end to another. And yeah, not so there's nothing like so much mail now, so it closed down. But it's reopened, in, as I said, in recent years as a touristy thing. And that's the house we rented in Sydenham in southeast London. That's the flat we had. There were four flats. And people often say, was it haunted? The answer is yes. No, I should have brought them. I'll put them in this. When I left, there are two students. I just wrote them a letter when I got here to start my degree, just to thank them for posting on my mail. And they were terrified. They wrote me a letter, which I still got, just saying they're frightened for the ghost that was in the rooms in here. I never saw it. There you go. They were absolutely terrified. That's Barbie, or Barbara Scammell. She's an East End lass. That's the medieval pits cutting a Roman floor. And we didn't have much of the Roman layers. Everything was intercutting, and there wasn't much left. The medieval stuff had, you know, these deep cesspits and so on had destroyed almost everything. And what we did find, though, was the graveyard of St. Nicholas Shambles. Dated 11th and 12th centuries. Most of the bodies lay in simple graves, no size to it, no wooden things, no coffin nails or anything. Analysis of the material showed a generally healthy population and a high incidence of similar traits suggests that many of the skeletons were of related individuals. And as you might expect, you know, they had osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, bone defects from anemia. One form of spinal degenerative disorder was four times more common in men than in women. It may have been related to lifting heavy objects. What we also found, which I copied down, doesn't say, the Shambles was a meat market, and we found a lot of young skeletons of butcher's boys with finger digits missing, when, presumably in training to be butchers, they chopped off their fingers. So there's one of the skeletons. We found, we couldn't, just because of the pressure of time. We photographed them and put a marker at each end and had a general plan, and we shaded in on that what was left of each one. And that's just a general view of us excavating. We opened it to the public, and we had a lot of these city business-suited city gents. Because remember, this is the city of London, you know, where all the businessmen were. They were a bit baffled. One of them actually started shouting, it's heresy, you shouldn't be doing this, you know, because we're excavating human remains. We did have to rebury them, all the ones that were lifted, in consecrated soil. It was all done, you know, properly and with respect and so on, but I think for some of the visitors it was a bit too much in the mid-70s. And this is what I took the photographs with. I began to get interested in site photography. And there are digital versions of something looking like that now. It's a film camera, obviously, it's a Nikkormat, beautiful camera. And also a Rolleiflex, which is a twin lens reflex camera, which gives you a laterally inverted image. Have any of you ever seen anything like that? Shake heads, no, I didn't think you would have. we took that as a large format camera, with really large format black and white film for just the photographic records, really. And we use the Nikkormat for color slides. So again, you know, an example of how recording techniques have changed. Yes, and that's me on a stepladder doing site photography. The bowler hat I'd bought the year before on another excavation. And it was actually good because the rim kept the rain off you when you're taking photographs. It was actually, you know, kept the rain off my glasses. But that's a hell of a stepladder. It went down even further than this. Yeah. I don't know, would you allow that these days with health and safety? Step ladder that big? Probably not.
You wouldn't allow the person who's holding the ladder to step away to take the photo.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, I know.
How tall was it?
Well, you can see, I'm only 5'5", so it's...
Yeah, but we can't see the bottom of it.
I know you can't. It must have been a good 3 or 4 metres high. It's enormous, yeah. So going deep into the early medieval layers, there's a well there. We actually found three of them, all in a straight line. We heard later there's actually a well in the basement of St. Paul's, so we thought there's an underground stream, you know, lost between the centuries to each other, but obviously known about at the time to whoever was making it. And we had these enormous concrete stanchions. There's one there, from the Victorian building that was destroyed, and it was the devil's own job to get rid of them with pneumatic drills. Which is good fun to use. And that's Barbie, who we've seen a few photographs. That's her boyfriend, later husband, Salvatore. They're still together and they live in Wales. I tried to teach him Cockney rhyming slang. It was coming from the Bronx, it didn't work. That's his parents visiting from America. But as I said, it's a bit of a personal journey, so there's people I know. That's Andy Boddington, who's a Lib Dem counselor in Shrewsbury at the moment, showing some students. Notice the flare jeans? I said there would be, yeah. Lots of flare there. So that was my main site, but every now and again I got taken off that. And we, in the autumn of 1975, we started excavating 48 to 50 Cannon Street near the big railway station. The cellar, again, had taken out all the surfaces. We only got cut features. Just drains, really. All we got was six Roman drains from Hadrianic date, about 100 to 140 AD. And we found a lot of pits containing mid to late Saxon pottery. And being that time of the year, the excavation took place in almost continual rain. And because we were so deep, they literally scooped out a building between the other buildings, as you'll see in a minute. So the sunlight never reached the ground surface at all. So we start as early as we can and worked on. In an effort to excavate as much as possible, we worked through three evenings by arc light. That's the site. That's probably a time exposure. So, I literally went on top of a building and photographed down through the... you can just see the foundations there. That isn't even street level. You can just see the beginnings of the drains there. That's us excavating by gas light, believe it or not. November 1975, there's a big arc lights there and there's the gas cylinders there and there, and another one there. And that's one of the drains, timberline Roman drains. And there it is. You can see the line of drains there, and the post holes. To take that photograph, I put my anorak on and buttoned it up, and had the camera on the edge of the building, which I took it from, which is about 100 feet up. And I leaned over the edge, and this Andy Boddington held on to the hood of my anorak, and I leaned over the edge. It's the only way to get this view. But you can see how deep we were. This is hardly even street level was about here. There's no other way to get a view like this, but I managed it. I tried it one other time with my eldest daughter, and I got berated for that. Leaned over a cliff, got my wife to hold on to the anorak. And I got good wildlife shots, you can do that, but not recommended.
What did the risk assessment say when you
proposed it? We didn't have risk assessments. No, there were literally none, you just got on with it. Oh, that's nice beer. So that's a plan. I tried to relate this to that photograph, and it's very difficult, actually. But there's that's a reconstruction of the drain, just wooden drains. I think those stakes there are probably the posts over there. And during this, I went just for a weekend with mentioned my personal life, my then girlfriend. We went to Paris to look at all the art galleries, and while we were away, guess what they blooming well found? Yeah, that. I know, people often say you never find, we're not really there to find buried treasure, but we did. Someone had thrown this into one of the drains. Emeralds linked by a gold chain, I presume is made for some Roman nobleman's wife or mistress or whatever, we don't know. We found it. It was whipped into the Museum of London. I only saw it in 1992 when I went to the Museum of London. Unfortunately, that's being refurbished and everything, so it'll reopen, I think, next year. Whether that'll be on display then, I don't know. But I have seen it. But, I think the emeralds came from North Africa, so it's an absolutely astonishing thing that who would throw that away? Perhaps there's a lover's tiff there that we'll never know about. Yeah. That's my housemate Debbie cooking at that flat in Sydenham. God. Living conditions in the 70s.
Is she a good cook?
I can't remember now. We're alive. This is the winter of 1975-76 now, so it's a bit gloomy. We carried on working all through the year because it's not a student dig. We're working for the Museum of London. We're on permanent work contract. Our wages then were £25 a week. £7.50 a week went in rent in London. Believe it or not.
What were your working hours?
9 to 4:30, 9 to 5, 5 days a week. Yeah, it's fairly standard, yeah. Another one of winter 75, 76. And then another rescue dig that was called away, Forum Southeast, the southeast corner of the Roman Forum, trying to locate the built between 120 and 125 AD. There wasn't much left of it because of all the, later building. So we worked closely with the contractors on a tight schedule to construct what was later to be called the NatWest Tower, which later, when it was built, became then, now being superseded, of course, the tallest building in Britain. So it was really beyond a rescue excavation. It was a salvage dig. So a four-piece of Roman occupation revealed a gravel surface and a regular gully and mud brick buildings, the walls of unfired bricks. This phase was destroyed by fire, probably by the burning of Londinium during the Boudiccan Revolt. I actually remember this. We recovered. I remember literally shoveling in bags of carbonized grain because almost nothing had been found of the Boudiccan Revolt, and we suddenly found lots. We found 25 kilograms of it. Amazing. Third period comprised surfaces of gravel and grey earth over the fire debris, but then no definite structures, very little was left. Fourth period comprised mortar, gravel and sand surfaces to the south, fragments of walling. And the medieval church of St. Dionysus Black Church has also discovered Wren often reused medieval foundations. So there's a photograph of part of the dig cleaned up. There's very little left, unfortunately, just odd stubs of walls here and there and layers. We weren't able to record it very well because the contractors was working at breakneck speed to build the enormous NatWest Tower. There's another. You can see the Roman brickwork there. There's one story here. If you ever go to London and see the NatWest Tower, one day I came in and they had a huge jackhammer connected to a JCB and they were destroying a piece of concrete wall that they had built and formed only a few days before. And I said, hey, you've just built this like 3 days ago. Why are you destroying it? And this shows a difference in technique, if you like. Now it's all done by GPS pointing and everything. He said, my pen slipped in the plans and the wall ended up 9 feet longer. And that was it. This was it, yeah? 1975. So they just erased it by destroying 9 foot of wall. And there's us digging in the Forum Southeast. It was a hell of a salvage dig. And there we are again, just shoveling out this Thames gravel. It was horrifying stuff to move. And then back, there's the Forum Southeast and a reconstruction there. And that's London Bridge, of course. Well, in fact, go back one. That's Louise, my sort of girlfriend from 50 years ago now. And in the following, that very hot summer which followed, she and someone else actually found the pilings for the Roman London Bridge here. And then that super hot summer ended, and the Thames level of the Thames rose. It was not rediscovered again and properly recorded until 1981. But I think she has the honour of finding it. And there it is. That's what they built once we finished digging. I just got this photo off the internet just to show you. It's now surrounded by lots of even taller buildings. That's just to give you an idea of what the Thames was like about 1,000 years ago. And that's the City of London, of course. There's lots of streams coming off. There's a river at the Fleet and there's another one, the Walbrook. I think the Tower of London to be was about there. And the GPO site was about, I think, there, somewhere like that, yeah. So by early 1976, we'd gone down to the late Saxon layers. We found the remains of a large building, 8850 to 950. So, yeah, beautiful Saxon timber trenches. That's a suggested reconstruction of what it might have looked like from, it's a building about the history of City of London, which I've got at home. I just photographed it from the book. Hope they won't mind. And that's my flatmate, Debbie, and she got married to Steve. I lost touch with them about 20 years ago, so I assume they're still married. I don't know. That was the wedding was at the University of London's church. And she was with the Institute of Archaeology at the time. He was doing a PhD on the psychology of the National Front. I don't know why, but there you go. If you don't know, the National Front is an extreme right-wing group, like a precursor of the British National Party, whatever they're called now. And that's time off from work. It's an evening playing darts at the Globe in Borough Market, which is near London Bridge Station. And that's a reconstruction of Roman London. You can see the Thames was very wide then. That's the City of London, that's Southwark. I don't know if you know London at all, but the Thames is about twice as wide then as it is now. And that's the wall. It's all, you know, massively built over. All these rivers have disappeared. They're all in brick-lined Victorian tunnels now. And to, actually going back there, the river was successively narrowed and narrowed and narrowed as time went on. So in Roman times, it was very wide, but when they wanted to build, it was easier to build inwards. So you just put a piling in there and just filled it with rubble from old buildings. And you want to do another one, you did that. And so the level of the Thames slowly got higher. The Thames flew faster and it got narrower, which is why the Thames is such a fast-flowing river now. The original Thames was a very wide, very slow-flowing river. That's one I found on the internet, which is actually very good. You can see the course and the extent of the Thames now and all its bridges, and you can see how much wider it was then. And it was a river with many small islands. And if you know London, lots of the some of the suburbs, like Bermondsey, Chelsea, and so on, the sea ending means an island in a river. And I think they were, where's Bermondsey? Is it over there somewhere? Chelsea, that might be Chelsea, I don't know. But yeah, there were lots of islands. It was nothing like what you'd expect now. What you get now. May 76. There's one of the skeletons from the cemetery of St. Nicholas Shambles being excavated. And there's my first photograph of planning frames. Never seen them in use before. I don't know if any of you go back that far. Maybe Mr. Merrini, I don't know.
Still use planning frames
there. I know. It's when did you start using them? That's the thing. We're just down beyond below the medieval stuff and onto the Roman layers by now. And that's May of 76 again. And this is the day that changed all our lives. Harris Matrix was introduced. That's my diary from the 6th of May 1976. Day of Sight conferences on using Ed Harris recording techniques. Andy very sceptical, as and so am I. We didn't like it at all. But it's to illustrate how things have changed. This is all standard procedure now. But that's the day it was introduced. Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, that very hot summer of 76, which has gone down to legend, began. We all went a little mad. In June 76, we dressed in drag and danced to the steps of St. Paul's. I think we did a can-can. We were thrown out for being disrespectful. There's me. Yeah, I'm still in touch with him. Not her, yeah. And not him, yeah. Yeah. And her, yeah. So yeah, most of us still in touch with each other, but yes, that was infamous. If you want to look at all these pictures, we got them all together about 7 years ago. There's a website, if you Google Hobley's Heroes, Brian Hobley was the chief urban archaeologist. A few years ago, we decided to put all our photos down. They're all there, all this 70s rubbish, but there you go. We had fun. Tea break? And this is just, I was almost ready to leave for university then, group photo Newgate Street in August 76, just before I left for Sheffield. There's me. And we had a coach trip out to Butser, which is just being set up then. So that's one of the early Iron Age buildings at Butser, just being built. That hot summer had broken, that's why it's so misty and foggy then. It started with almost torrential rain in the autumn of 76. And then I left for university, but I returned to volunteer at the Milk Street excavation in the summer of 77. That's just a photograph showing the same people with, I don't know if it's slightly more or slightly less, flared jeans. I don't know. And I nearly got myself killed. I went down with this chap, John Maloney, there. You can see the layers. Workers were building a telecommunications tunnel, you know, to put cabling in under the modern street levels. It was just far enough below the street surface that we could again find look at the Roman layers, which we were measuring there. Then between us and where the navvies were digging this tunnel, the whole blooming thing collapsed. There wasn't much shoring there. We had safety helmets on for once, and that's about it. That was the fifth time I was nearly killed on an excavation, actually. It's the only one I've got a picture of. I told my daughters they're blooming lucky to have me as a dad because I nearly didn't make it. There was a trench collapse when I was at Dover Castle, another one on the Newgate Street site, and two, was it 1972, 73, when I was excavating at Baynard's Castle in London. But yeah, in fact, three people were killed in the 1970s, three young archaeologists, because no health and safety, no regard for anything. It was just good fun for us. We just went in there and did it. So that's really the end of my story of the working for the Museum of London. I've got to rattle through this very quickly. Never mind. So I'll end by showing you some other photographs of other digs I was on, really to illustrate that the sort of things we were doing then. This was the area of big area excavations. Often we never knew when we were coming back. Some of them were research, some of them were rescue. But the idea now, we excavate a small area, sampling it. We excavated big areas then, and big means you'll see. Several, 1971, this has worked its way into the textbooks now. I worked on the excavations of an Iron Age hill fort in the Cotswolds, Crickley Hills. In any of your textbooks? No? Oh, well. We excavated the whole of the hilltop, exposing the Iron Age village. So this is a reconstruction of the earlier phase of the Iron Age village, and that's later phase when they converted from longhouses to roundhouses. This is a bit of an innovation because these longhouses weren't known in Britain very much at the time. They were known all over Europe, the linear band ceramic longhouses, but we were one of the very first digs to find that they actually were building in this style in England. Philip Dixon, who's excavating that very first dig of mine at Greenwich, he's now retired as professor of archaeology in Nottingham, but he was the director of this. I don't know if you can see, it's not very clear, but you can see the ground surface there wasn't much below, 10 or 15 centimetres down, there's not much depth of anything. And there you can see the post holes, one of the longhouses, and that, and a horse came onto the site somehow. We're about 800, I don't know how much this is in metres, I've never converted, about 880 feet up on the Cotswold escarpment. But one tale I tell is this very old man came to the site one day in 73. We'd never seen him, and Alice Pandrich, one of the site supervisors, I can't do her Geordie accent very well, but she said, "Have you had a hard time getting up here, Hinnie?" And he said, "Don't you know who I am, madam?" And it was blooming Mortimer Wheeler. He was so old, but he died 3 years later in 76. But he was so old then and hadn't had a public profile. No one's seen him publicly for years. Then fortunately, we recognised him. He was given, you know, a guided tour, of course. But yeah, famous visitor. And there, as you can see, that's the trench from the Neolithic Causeway enclosure. And again, normally the depth of archaeology was hardly anything below the... You just took off the grass and about that much of turf and you got it. It was, yeah, the whole surface was exposed. And this is what I meant when we did big area excavations. This is 1972. We had a six-week dig with 120 volunteers. And each of these is a 10 metres square. And you can see that big roundhouse there, the postals beautifully, and some of the longhouses there. There's one there, there's another one there. I think there's another one there, another one there. Yeah, it was amazing. And we lived in a place called Ullenwood, which is all destroyed now. I couldn't find it on Google Maps anymore. It was an ex-Polish refugee camp from World War II. And we lived in these sort of Nissen huts. It was very Spartan, I think. Okay, another dig I went on. Again, it illustrates a massive scale of excavation in the 70s. Very beautiful. Some of you might have been there. It's Castle Acre Castle in Norfolk. I keep meeting people who say, "Oh, I've been there." So I don't know if any of you have. The castle had been involved in the Stephen and Matilda War, our first and largely forgotten civil war, between 1139 and 1153. Unfortunately, there's a lesson to you all, always take your camera with you. I didn't have it on the very first day of the dig. I was back at the campsite, and I didn't record this thing. It's a diesel-powered conveyor belt to get all the soil out of the keep. And the Royal Air Force brought it in and put it in there with one of those enormous twin-bladed Chinook helicopters. I haven't got a photograph of it. Bloody annoying. I know, it's really annoying.
That's what we need for Castleton Common.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can see how steep the trenches were as we were going down into the keep. Somewhere in there, I have got a better picture of him, but what's his name? John... I've forgotten his surname. It'll come to me, never mind. He's quite famous now. But there's the conveyor again. And no health and safety. This is how we got down to the keep to excavate. And it goes down, down, down. Just an enormous wooden ladder. And I didn't get much of a tan that part of the summer. Because, out of the sunshine, slowly taking down that down into the keep. And, of course, there's no digital stitching then. So this is several black and white photos. You can see the join I put together and I've photographed. That's the keep there. You can actually go and see this now. I went and saw it in 91 when the children were little. I think Rosie had a tantrum then. She didn't want to see it. My eldest daughter. But it's a beautiful village. You're out that way. Because at this end of the village is the castle. In the middle, just there, is the, think of the Church of St. James, St. James the Great, 13th, 14th century. The far end of the village is Castle Acre Priory, which is the best preserved Cluniac Priory in England. So if you're into medieval archaeology or medieval history, that village is well worth a visit. And in the spring of 74, I spent several weeks excavating a deserted medieval village. It's Thrislington, or Thurstanton, as it is called then, in County Durham. The village had been occupied for 150 years, from 1100 to 1350. I think 1350 is very significant, because, of course, the Black Death, 1347. I don't know if you know, but there are something like 3,200 deserted or lost medieval villages in England due to famine, pestilence, economic decline, whatever, and we're excavating one of them. This whole landscape is very depressing. They're just stripping the landscape for a dolomite quarry. And there's the factory there. And that's Dave, my friends, on a very wet day. And again, I put lots of photographs together. But you can see we just had to excavate everything because it would be gone within a few weeks when the quarry just encroached and stripped it all out. You can see the walls, the various buildings of the village. And yeah, the most remarkable thing wasn't anything to do with the dig. We had a violent thunderstorm. We saw a tornado. It's the only time I've ever seen one in England. You can get an idea of the scale. You can see the chimneys of the houses there and the trees. I've no idea how big that would be, a couple hundred meters. And just to finish off, this is what it's actually like. A few young people. Once all the warm summer excavations are over and you carry on working through the winter, this is me working in a 3rd century AD Roman site in Cirencester, Gloucestershire, in November 72. And not long after this photo was taken, even the plank sank into the mud. So, right, there you go, finished.
Thank you very much.
Finished quite early, yeah, good.
Do we have questions for Ken? I'll start off.
Oh, go on.
So what do you think now are the big differences from when you started to when we're now on our... starting.
It's got standardized soon after this. So lots of stuff that was, you know, like the Harris Matrix that was coming in 76, certainly by 1980, that was becoming standard. Site photography is becoming standardized. A lot of the recording techniques that were rudimentary then were becoming standardized. I don't know about health and safety because I had a big gap raising a family. When I started again in 2010, it was all very, very different. The idea of wearing safety helmets was thought to be a bit naff. There almost was no health and safety then, and it was really quite dangerous. But we laughed at it. It was just a big joke to us. The more danger there was, the more fun it was, which is, you know, absolutely ridiculous in modern terms. We did put ourselves quite in what you would regard as peril. Working conditions weren't very good. We lived in awful living conditions. That flat I showed you was unheated. We had enough money to live on, but not enough money to heat it, which is all right in the summer, but in the winter it was freezing cold. We had one small paraffin heater for that enormous flat, the four of us. I hope your working conditions when you finish your degrees and go out to work will be a lot better. I mean, there's no central heating. In fact, one day in that flat it got so cold that all the water vapor in one of the bedrooms condensed out, and it was a fog in the bedroom. Now, I know I told my daughter this because she was complaining at a cold flat she had a few years ago, and I told her that she shut up at that point. But yeah, I mean, the conditions were, you know, now very, very primitive. But it was great. It was great fun. It really was.
What did the general public understand and think of what you were doing?
We didn't have a lot of the guided tours. Now there's no internet then. I mean, things like Time Team, a lot of the documentaries are on now. This, of course, didn't exist. The general public's view, when we let them in at all, there wasn't much interaction between us and the public. That site in Newgate Street, we let the public, which are mainly business-suited businessmen from the City of London, have a look around. We gave them some guided tours, and that was about it. It's one of the few excavations I knew where we actually interacted with the public. The guided community archaeology wasn't known. Some local... there were local societies which sometimes joined in, like the City of London Archaeological Service, which a great load of volunteers lived around London, came and joined us at the weekends, but not much. There was a separation between professional archaeologists and the general public, and a few small private groups which joined now and again. None of the community excavations didn't exist then at all. Interacting with the public, putting photographs on Facebook so the public could see what you were doing. None of that existed. That was a big, big separation. I don't know, because I took this enormous gap to raise a family when it changed. You can ask Colin that one. He'll know.
What about now archaeology is quite heavily influenced by science and scientific breakthroughs?
There's very little of that. Just recording the skeletons, for example, at Newgate Street, it was quite rudimentary. You could tell what bone deformations were visible on the scene, but there's no DNA analysis, none of the looking at teeth to see where people came from. That literally didn't exist then. None of that science was known. You know, the human genome was only sequenced in 2002. It was in that technology was far in the future. In fact, I was talking to someone the other day about photography. We took sight photographs with film cameras, of course. So you shot off a reel of 36 photographs. You couldn't hold up the dig till they were processed to see if they were all right, or some of them blurred, or too dark, or too light. You carried on with the dig. By the time you got them back from the chemist, you hope they were all right. So this is, you know, nowadays you can check individually if your photographs are good. If not, take another one. So if you took a bad photo, it was just too late because the dig had progressed. There wasn't much of what you'd call science. We recorded it, you know, Poma Trace, as we do now. And our sight records were as good as they can be, but probably not a patch on what you can do today. There's no no radar, no... magnetometry, none of that. I don't think it's just UPR. None of it was coming in, yeah. In fact, where the site was in relation to other buildings was only known from old maps. No, I told you this in... Tim might remember. I told this tale in 2011, so I'll tell it one more time and that I'll shut up forever.
It'll be on the podcast.
No, it'll be on the podcast. All right. Before I started with the Museum of London in March of 75, a few weeks before, my friend Andy Boddington, one of those photographs, was on a watching brief. I think it was a central line to see, you know, what was being recorded as they were removing the stuff over, you know, to build another building. Central line, I think it was central line, one of the early lines. It was just a cut and cover. They dug a trench through London with navvies in the 19th century, built a brick tunnel, put the underground railway inside it and covered it over, and modern buildings are over it now. But its exact position in relation to modern buildings was not that accurately recorded. You know, and you could do it, but not so well. So one day the JCB scraped this curved brick surface and broke through to it. And Andy looked over and he could see the blooming the railway lines below with a pile of bricks on it. And he actually ran to the nearest underground station, managed to convince the station manager to stop the underground trains, or there would have been disaster. And this is not well known. It's actually been suppressed because in the autumn of the year before, in the autumn of 1974, there's a famous Moorgate tube disaster when two underground trains crashed together and many were killed. So I think the London Underground they just didn't want this to be known. They suppressed it completely. So you know, but not many people do.
Ken, when you started, was archaeology a career?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working as an archaeologist since 1971.
And there was a career path ahead of...
There wasn't a career path. I came here to sew up the academic side of it, but most people were working as I did, going from one dig to another, basically with a rucksack on your back, hitchhiking around the country. And they were forming archaeological units like the London one, there's a Norfolk one, and so on. Similar to the setup now, but yeah.
And what qualifications did you have to be taken on to become an archaeologist?
None. I literally started. I just went along and they said, can I dig? And they said, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I did 3 months working for the Guildhall Museum, excavating Baynard's Castle. I just went there to visit a friend of mine and she said, oh, they need some diggers. And then the excavation director is just passing through. I said, oh, here, you're looking for people? And he said, yeah. He said, what have you done? And I just, as he was walking through the site, I told him what I'd done. He said, can you start Monday? That was it. And same for the Museum of London. I had a quick 10-minute interview, and he said, can you start on Monday? There's no looking into qualifications. Very few of us had degrees. It was all very, very ad hoc compared to now.
Are there some things that you prefer, techniques, methods, that you prefer from then compared to now?
Not really, no. The only thing is, I suppose, looking back on it, it was a lot of fun. It really was. We had a great time. I mean, beer was 6 or 7p a pint, so you could get actually drunk for about 20p. Ridiculous, yeah.
Oh, sorry, my mistake. I should have narrowed down.
Archaeology. Archaeology. Yes. I was talking about the important things. No, just recording things that, you know. Plans, sections, doing site photography, theodolites, all that stuff that you do now. We didn't have GPS, we didn't have total stations. Obviously, digital photography is a world away and a world better than anything we could do then with film cameras. Film cameras often weren't adapted for the range of colours you found on the site, all the browns and reds you get in soils. We weren't very well adapted for that at all. Some of the photographs we got came out very strange looking. We experimented with different films, different grades of films, just to, you know, now you can fiddle with a digital camera and just get the picture you want. That wasn't available then.
Didn't you have multiple cameras though, different kinds of cameras?
Just those two, yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Because we used to use black and whites and colours and slides and stuff, didn't we?
Yeah, that was very, very normal, but you did have lots of discussions about which films to use, so it was really huge, your Kodak.
Yeah.
One had a greener tinge and one had
Yeah, that's right, yeah. We were experimenting because some of them gave a very green tinge to a lot of the photographs, and we didn't want that, didn't record the, you know, the reds and browns and yellows you often got with soils.
Is there any one particular site you worked on back in the day where if you'd got the modern techniques, you think, oh, I wish we had those techniques and could have learned?
I don't know. I have a lot of fondness for that beautiful medieval castle, Castle Acre. We only excavated in the keep yard. I wish we'd gone into the upper bailey. You can see lots of humps and bumps there, and we never dug it. I wish that could have been done. That was just such a pretty place to live and work. Of course, the other one, of course, was with Paul Mellors and Oronsay, which I haven't shown at all, in the Hebrides. That was extraordinarily beautiful, tiny little island. We went there by Land Rover when the tide was out between Oronsay, where the dig was, and Colonsay, where we were staying. Colin knows about this. That's where I corrupted him. the following year, but and the tides were out. We went by boat between the two islands. It was beautiful.
Okay, when did you then return to archaeology and become a legend in the community archaeology?
In 2010, when I retired, I emailed Colin and said, "What's going on?" He emailed me back, and that's all started up from then. So thank you, Colin. Yeah.
Any more questions for Ken? Excellent. We can show our appreciation.
Okay.
To Ken. Thank you very much. I have one more question just for Colin, and I'm not going to throw him under the bus this time. For the listeners on the podcast, is there any update on the state of the department?
There's not very much to report from last time, I suppose. We still don't know things like what's happening to all the fixed-term contract staff, no news on that. The only thing that has changed a bit is that there have been various documents produced about collections and facilities and equipment, and they've all gone into the implementation group, and there are various sort of vague rumours about what may or may not be possible happening. But so there's no substantial changes in what we know, but there has been more information supplied and various documents produced, and it's about, so we're still largely in doubt.
Thank you for listening to Archaeology and Ale. For more information about our podcast and guest speaker, please visit our page on the Archaeology Podcast Network. You can get in touch with us at Archaeology in the City on Facebook, WordPress, Instagram or Twitter. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.